All right, listeners, we are back for the second hour, and Brian is co-hosting, and we have Dr. David Ray Griffin on, and I'm really excited, Brian, that we do have him with us. He is an expert on 9/11. He's written two bestsellers on it. He's acquired much fame as the author of The New Pearl Harbor, Disturbing Questions About the Bush Administration and 9/11, as well as 12 other noted books that he has had published. He's thought by many to be the most respected truth-sayer of the 9/11 movement, and he is a former professor of philosophy of religion and theology, emeritus at Claremont School of Theology in Claremont Graduate University, and he also taught there, and co-director, Center for Process Studies, as well as former assistant professor of theology at the University of Dayton. But he graduated from Northwest Christian College and then the University of Oregon, where he earned his MA, and then the as well as the School of Theology at Claremont, and his PhD is from Claremont Graduate School. He has received some 60 theologians worldwide nomination for inclusion in the Handbook of Christian Theologians, and is the recipient of the Book Prize of the Scientific and Medical Network in 2000, as well as winner of the Helios Foundation Award in 2006. He has served as editor of the SUNY series in Constructive Postmodern Thought, which published 31 volumes in postmodern is one of my areas of expertise in my doctorate, postmodernity, so that's interesting as well. And Dr. Griffin says he wonders if there is a word of truth in the 9/11 Commission report, and I'm one of those people who read it and don't believe anything in it. And he said it was written by, I believe the name is Zelico. You could correct me on that, David, when you get on. And he also says the supposed hijackers are free and have been interviewed by the BBC, and the flight manifest has never been revealed. I find that extremely interesting. He also says the government has issued total dishonesty. So, Brian and I both warmly welcome you, Dr. Griffin.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
You have a great video out. I watched your video. And you certainly have done a lot of research on this 9/11. What, first of all, made you do that?
Well, when 9/11 itself happened, I accepted the kind of traditional liberal position that 9/11 was blowback for U.S. foreign policy, and I had been working on a book on global problems, and I realized then that although I had thematized the notion of American imperialism in all the chapters, you know, whether it was the global ecological crisis or global apartheid, I didn't have a chapter on U.S. imperialism as such, and so I went to work on that, and pretty soon that chapter, it got so long, I realized I was writing another book, and I had that book about two-thirds finished when somebody was introduced to me as someone who thought 9/11 was an inside job. And I talked to him for a while and then said, well, I'd need to look at some evidence. And he said he would send it, and he did. And I looked at it and didn't find it convincing and went back to my book. And I tell that because many people say, oh, you people in the 9/11 truth movement, you just hate America, you hate Bush, and so you are just looking for something to accuse him of. Well, that's not true, and, you know, most people in the movement didn't get in. I didn't get in until 2003, and most people didn't get in until 4, 5, or 6, or 7. So we were people who accepted the official story for a year or longer. But finally, a few months later, another colleague sent the timeline, the information about Paul Thompson's complete 9/11 timeline. And so I started reading through that, and it didn't take very long there. These were mainly stories that surfaced, appeared shortly after 9/11 and then never appeared again because they contradicted the official narrative. And and there are literally hundreds, even thousands of such stories by now, and they so strongly contradict the official story that I then started looking more seriously at it and finally started writing what I thought was going to be a journal article. And, of course, it got so long, it became my first book, The New Pearl Harbor.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I when people, some of my listeners found out you were coming on, they sent questions, and I have a list of questions here, Dave, so let me start with the first one, all right?
Okay.
This person asked, can Dr. Griffith comment on those who would profit from the events of 9/11?
Well, yes, I wrote about this in that first book, The New Pearl Harbor, and I've written about it in my subsequent books. The latest one, The New Pearl Harbor Revisited, is the seventh book, and on 9/11, and in it, I pretty much summarized the main points that were in the intervening books. And so the idea is that if you take these two books together, The New Pearl Harbor and The New Pearl Harbor Revisited, you get most of everything you really need to understand both the official story and then the problems with it. And so in this latest book, I discuss this even more. But the main things were they clearly had wanted to go to war in Afghanistan and Iraq. Those had been planned in advance. They'd been wanting to, the neocons, Cheney and Wolfowitz and so on, had been wanting to attack Iraq since 1992. They also had this Patriot Act they wanted to pass. That was clearly already written before 9/11. They also had this new doctrine that Sarah Palin has made famous now by not knowing it, what it was, the Bush Doctrine, which is the doctrine that contradicts traditional international law, which is that you cannot attack another nation unless you have certain knowledge that that nation is almost ready, going to attack you imminently, too imminently to take it to the UN Security Council. And Cheney and the other neocons never liked that and had been working against it. Well, 9/11 gave them their chance, and so they worked out this new doctrine, which was actually written by Philip Zelikow, who later became the executive director of the 9/11 Commission. He wrote National Security Strategy of the United States of America 2002 under Condoleezza Rice's under her request. And this says that given the new dangers in the world, we can no longer accept this traditional stance, and we declare the right to attack our enemies before they get strong enough to attack us. So that was really the basis for going to a war in Iraq.
So
and then
saying,
the more general motive was to increase military spending, mm-hmm. and of course that has been an enormous success, increasing it by many hundreds of billions of dollars.
So the Bush Doctrine then is really comprised of our being allowed to have a preemptive strike when there really is not, we're not really at war with anybody.
That's right, and when there's no imminent threat to us from them, you can be talking about, oh, maybe 10 years down the road, they're going to be ready to, they might be ready to attack us, so let's attack them now while they're still weak. That's the new doctrine. That's the Bush Doctrine.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. By the way,
you know, at Nuremberg, unprovoked war was called the supreme international crime. So we have sent, on the basis of 9/11, we have committed the supreme international crime twice with our attacks on Afghanistan and Iraq.
Well, you know, that's interesting that you say that. And, you know, I know what, going into Iraq that they tried to achieve several different things. How is it that everybody's sitting by and letting us do this? Is Russia now coming back and challenging us by going into Georgia and hooking up with North Korea and South America?
Well, clearly the Russians are fed up with us because they know that we instigated Georgia's attack on South Ossetia, to which they responded. And then now Russia gets blamed for, we dominate the world press enough that we've been able to get Russia blamed, at least in America and in Europe, for their invasion of Georgia. Now, of course, the Russians weren't completely innocent here. They did some things to provoke Georgia, but Georgia fell for it. And so Georgia was the aggressor there. There's no doubt about that. And so it was interesting that last week, on the day after 9/11, Russia allowed this new movie called Zero, produced by this Italian member of the European Parliament, Giulietta Chiesa, which really tells the truth about 9/11, allowed that to be played on Russian national TV. And then they had a discussion about it in which many leading Russians said they did not believe the official story at all. They believed the movie Zero, that 9/11 was an inside job.
Well, you know, apparently many Americans, I know my listeners, the majority of them believe it was an inside job. But when you said that this particular director told the story about 9/11, did that include the whole thing with the Pentagon and Shanksville, and that none of this really ever occurred?
Yeah, Zero is a 2-hour movie, and I think people debate what is the best movie out of this nature that that covers the whole or at least a good deal of the aspects of 9/11, Loose Change, Final Cut, or Zero. And I think they're equally good. Zero's probably going to appeal to an older audience, and Loose Change, Final Cut to a somewhat younger audience. But I think they're both equally fine films, and either one can give you an overview of most of the aspects, as you say, the Pentagon and Flight 93, as well as the World Trade Center.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Brian?
I'm here. I'm not very familiar yet with Dr. Griffin's work, so I am listening a little bit to try and gather where to start with my questions.
All right. Well, while you think about that, I'll ask the next question that a listener had sent in. And, he can certainly answer it. And the question is, could Dr. Griffin please comment on the size of the debris pile vertically, as it appears in pictorial evidence? It is my observation that the two towers are no more than 1 to 2 stories tall, and pictorial evidence suggests that the sub-basements are virtually intact and empty.
Yeah, I don't know about the sub-basements, that part of it, because a lot of debris certainly went down there and filled them in. But the main point is the first one the person makes, which is that the piles of these twin towers were only about 4 to 6 stories high. And that is remarkable when you consider that these buildings were each 110 stories high, and that they had steel columns running from the sub-basements up through the roofs. And so if somehow the buildings had just fallen over, you would have those enormous steel columns. There were 287 of them. You had 47 massive core columns in the core of the building, and then 240 columns around the perimeter. And somehow those columns all got sliced into pieces short enough that you could end up with a debris pile only a few stories high. So there's only one way, from a scientific point of view, if you know anything about physics and steel, there's only one way this can happen, and that was with some sort of things we can loosely call explosives. Now, some of them may not technically be explosives. They can be incendiaries, like thermite, thermite. But something that can slice steel. So something that can get steel very, very hot, very quickly, and cut these long columns into many, many pieces. Most of them seem to be cut into pieces from 20 to 50 feet long. So that's a lot of slicing going on in each one of those towers.
What are the odds that those buildings, that the whole thing, the planes, et cetera, are either holographs or green screened or, you know, the, what then would be the odds of using a DUE, a directed energy wave, at the buildings?
Nobody can say, and you know, this is such speculative that I don't get into the question of how it was really done. The only thing we need at this stage is to point out the many, many reasons, which are over a dozen reasons, why the official story can't be true. And that means that something extraordinary had to be going on to slice the steel. The official story, according to which the only three sources of energy would have been the impact of the planes, which, you know, hit a limited part of the building, and that was over about an hour or more before the buildings came down. So all you had at the time the buildings came down were fire and gravitation, and the idea that a combination of fire and gravity could have brought those buildings vertically down at virtually free-fall speed with all these pieces of steel sliced into many pieces, and virtually all of the concrete blown into very tiny dust particles. The odds against that, now that we're used to talking not only in terms of billions but trillions, I would say the odds are probably about 100 trillion to one.
I have two questions here in the chat room, and one says, please ask Dr. Griffin if the Iraq war wasn't to get the sale of oil back onto the dollar, as Saddam Hussein declared the sale of oil would be for euros. And the other one is, why was the debris shipped to Kilvan Coal on Staten Island?
On the question of Iraq, it does seem like there were many, many motivations for the war in Iraq. All or at least most of them had to do with oil, getting control of oil. And it does seem like one of the motivations may have been to try to keep oil on the dollar standard. With regard to why the steel was shipped to that particular shipyard, I don't know about that. But the important point the questioner may, brings out with that question is the fact that virtually all the steel was shipped away, so that they had only a tiny little bit to do research on. And in most situations, this is a federal offense. You can't take a matchbook from a crime scene without potentially being arrested by the FBI. And yet in this situation, the FBI and the city of New York and the state of New York, so all three levels of government, allowed all this steel to be whisked away, not only allowed it, but allowed it to be, you know, gave top priority was given to getting the steel out of there. Now, they claim that the motive was to remove the steel so that they could do the search and rescue, that there might still be some people alive there. But with regard to Building 7, it is well, you know, they state time and time again, no lives were lost in Building 7. They knew that at the time because it had been evacuated before the building came down at 5:20 that afternoon. And so there would have been no need to get rid of the steel under Building 7 in order to facilitate the search for bodies. And yet the NIST report on Building 7, which just came out this last week, still gives that lame excuse. That's why the steel had to be removed. And by the way, NIST in its report, it's a just an amazingly, well, nothing amazes us about NIST anymore, but if you hadn't known before, you would be amazed at how dishonest this is. For example, the New York Times had reported that three fire professors from a very prestigious university that does specialize in fire engineering matters had done studies of steel taken both from one piece from the towers, one of the towers, and one piece from Building 7, and that in both cases the steel had been thinned. In fact, looked like a piece of Swiss cheese. It had holes in it. Well, this requires temperatures of enormous, much more than just melting steel. We're talking up in the 4,000 to 5,000 degree range. And the New York Times called this the deepest mystery uncovered yet in the investigation of the World Trade Center. And this was included, their report, these three professors' report, was included in the first report on the towers, or on the three buildings, which came out, that FEMA put out back in 2002, which actually had some honest work in it. And this was in the appendix. And this appendix reported on this, said the steel had been oxidized and sulfidized. And sulfur, by the way, is something that is used to bring down the temperature at which steel will melt. The difference between thermite and thermate is that thermate has sulfur added to it. And they said this demands further investigation. And NIST, which then was tasked to do the official investigation, the definitive investigation, does not even mention this steel, does not even mention the fact that FEMA said this needed to be investigated because it was very mysterious.
Mm-hmm. Brian.
Very mysterious, given the official story that the buildings were brought down simply by fire and gravity.
Yeah, well, I saw that in its report, too, and it's bunk. Go ahead, Brian.
Well, I've got two questions. I'll start with a smaller one. I was going through some of the videos the other day, some of the news reports, and time and again, you could see firemen coming out. You could actually hear the guys yelling at the crowd. You could hear what was coming over the radios, where they were talking about they had found secondary devices, pull back. What can you tell us about these secondary devices they found before the buildings came down?
Yeah, that's a term that people in the trade use to refer to bombs. They're called secondary devices because the idea is that in terrorist attacks, there will be an explosion. And then the idea is that people are going to go in to treat the wounded, and then the really big explosion will come, and that's the secondary device. So whether they were really secondary or not, the fact is that we're talking about explosives in the buildings. And I reported this at great length in my previous book just prior to this one, which is called 9/11 Contradictions, an open letter to Congress and the press. And you won't be surprised that neither Congress nor the press has responded as of yet. But I had a whole chapter devoted to the question, were there explosions going off in the Twin Towers? And another chapter devoted to whether there were explosions reported in Building 7. And as you say, on 9/11 itself, all sorts of people were reporting massive explosions in the buildings. We had over 100 members of the Fire Department of New York who gave testimonies, gave these oral testimonies that have been made available by the New York Times, even though the New York Times has never reported on what's in the testimonies with regard to these explosions. NIST reports that it read through all of these oral histories, but never saw fit to mention any of these testimonies. But besides them, there were journalists, including Wall Street Journal journalists, who reported, and their building was right next door to the towers, so they had a very good view. And this one guy says, I just watched the building come down floor by floor by floor. He had no doubt that it was being brought down by explosives. And then you had, as you say, many, many firemen saying there were bombs or explosives going off in the building, and these were reported by mainstream television that day. I mean, whether you're talking about ABC, NBC, CBS, CNN, or even Fox News, if you get that old footage, you can, and I report it in there where you can find it, you'll see that all the networks and cables were reporting on explosions, and by the next day, they weren't talking about this anymore.
Okay, David, we have a phone call. We're going to let him ask the question, and then we'll let you answer it when he's offline, since we've got all these lines going. So, caller, what is your first name, and where are you calling from? Ryan, did you catch that?
No.
We're having that problem again.
Yeah, I tell you what, caller, if you can hear us, if you would hang up, call back into Frank. We're getting ready to go to break here, so we're not going to have a lot of time to get in a question before the break. But as soon as we come back, we will come in and put you on the air with the caller or with our guest.
All right, and before we go to break, Brian, did you have another question before I ask one?
I have one, but I tell you what, this one may take a little bit of time to explain, so go right ahead.
Okay, David, what I wanted to ask you was, what about the issue of the molten metal? You know, we see people walking on that pile, and if it was as hot as they were claiming, wouldn't they have been burned just by walking on it, maybe even cooked? And why was it steam coming from it?
Oh, well, they did report that their boots, if they walked on it very long, their rubber boots would burn through. So it was very hot. And
yeah, you're talking after the fall, right?
After the fall.
Okay. I know
after the fall,
there have been questions about before the fall, how hot the metal would be and the people in the windows.
Yeah, no, well, I know that we can certainly ask them that. But this was people reporting that they've seen people walking on a molten metal after they fell.
Well, they weren't walking on; they were walking on the ground, which was very hot in places, and it was verified as being terribly hot for several months afterwards.
Okay. Well, this is our commercial cue, ladies and gentlemen. We will be back right after these messages.
Okay, we're back, and we're getting that caller on, aren't we, Brian?
Yes, ma'am.
All right, you go right ahead.
All right, caller, are you with us?
I am.
All right, go right ahead.
Yes, thank you, Johnny, once again, and Dr. Griffin. I was on just before, and they told me that you might be interested, Dr. Griffin, unless you've heard of it, about the news report I heard when I was living in England of the four other planes that the United States military informed independent television their Air Force had shot down. And nobody else has ever brought this out again. And I've tried to get the tape of that news broadcast, but I've been unsuccessful so far in speaking to Mr. John Sushi, the newsreader. Now, the other point I want to make is that I'm sure you agree that people have different theories and that they should actually inter-exchange information, and that it doesn't become like the Kennedy assassination where each one remains with his own historical fact without interrelating with another author. I bring that up because one of my friends who was in intelligence, His Honor Mayor Jim Boots Rothstein, vice detective at a level of intelligence here in New York, said that he does believe there was government involvement, but there's a name, Issam Barbuti, who also had to do with the Oklahoma City bombing, who highly figures in all of this. Are you aware of this? And also, I suggest that you should get in touch with Mayor Rothstein.
David?
Okay. I don't know about this story about shooting down. What I do know is that, I mean, four other planes, if that's what he said. What I do know is that we do not know what really happened that day. That is very clear with Flight 93, as I stress in the New Pearl Harbor Revisited. You have very contradictory testimony, not only between what the government says and what the people at around Shanksville say, but within the Shanksville community, people that there's no reason why they would be not telling the truth. but report a plane going one direction, and other people report a plane going another direction. And the news media reported that there were two different crash sites there, two different places about 6 miles away that were cordoned off. So it does seem like there were two planes that that went down there, or two places at least they were calling crash sites, because at the official crash site there was no sign of a plane. So again, I don't get very much involved in trying to figure out what really happened that day. And so that would be my answer to the second part of the question, too. I know there are all these theories, and I don't take any issue with people trying to find out what really happened that day. That's natural human curiosity. And sometimes the people who are going down that route come up with some very interesting information, some of which I've used. So I'm grateful for it. But it's just not my approach. I should restrict my approach insofar as I can make the distinction between what, you know, all the evidence that shows that the official story is not true. Now, sometimes that brings you over into what really happened, because the evidence that the towers were brought down by explosives of some sort, and the evidence that whatever happened at the Pentagon definitely was not Flight 77 hitting it. So you can't make a radical distinction, but insofar as one can make the distinction, I try to stick to the evidence against the official story, because at this stage of the story, what we need to do is convince sufficient people and convince the right people that a new investigation is needed.
Eric, does that answer your question? I guess he's moved on. So, Brian, go ahead with yours then.
All right. This question, Dr. Griffin, it's a little bit different from the ones I normally ask, so I ask you to bear with me for a second. if you look out since September 11, 2001, we've seen what appears to be, at least in our media, as Russia becoming more of the old Soviet state that it used to be. You've seen the crash of the dollar, or at least what appears to be an oncoming crash. We've seen the euro go up. And lately I've seen oil nations talking about consolidating their currency like an EU, and they had been talking about pinning it to a dollar, but it wouldn't surprise me if they go to the euro instead. If this was if it was an inside job, have we brought these different things upon ourselves? You know, was this the catalyst, and have we brought it on ourselves?
Well, this is another question that I don't get into. I try to stick to things that I think I know something about. And this is in the category of, you know, what really was going on with 9/11, that is, who was really behind it. I focus on the operational level, where I say it appears that Dick Cheney was right in the center of things, and of course Rumsfeld and Myers and the Pentagon had to be too. But who was behind them? Who was telling them what to do? I don't get into that.
I'm not so much wondering who was behind it, and that
they were not just working autonomously. And then the question, well, if it is the elite of the world or the elite of this country, what were their ultimate motivations, and what were their motivations with regard to the dollar and so on?
Well, I don't want to get too much into
all these different theories. Some of them may be true, but it's not something that I get into.
Okay. Well, I don't want to get so much into who was behind it and was it a plan and, you know, the elite and all that. But I'm just simply looking at, since 9/11, we've tried to fund a war in Afghanistan, a war in Iraq, and we've spent tons of money, and we've watched the price of oil go up. You know, I'm just kind of saying, because, you know, even how do you word this?
Well, I think I know what you're getting at, and the question
looking
would
at the
be,
monetary.
Well, can I break into both of you, because we have another caller? So let's get the caller on in line, and then we can resume. Caller, what is your first name, and where are you calling from?
Tim from New Mexico.
Okay, Tim, go ahead with your question, and then our guest will answer it. You can hang up after you give him the question.
Well, I had two comments also. What about the Scott packs on the back of the firefighters exploding? What accounts for that, Mr. Griffin? And also, how come
What on the backs of the firefighters?
The Scott packs, the oxygen bottles that the firefighters wear on their backs. What made those explode? Did they put bombs in the Scott packs? That's what they call them.
I don't know anything about that.
What is requiring oxygen bottles exploding in the fire trucks and that? And also, how come most of the people that are into this 9/11 truth movement don't talk about Hurricane Erin, this huge hurricane headed right towards New York City?
I did have a guest on. Dr. Judy Wood talked about the hurricane, but go ahead with that.
Yeah, how come you never discussed this, Mr. Griffin? I mean, this is pretty unprecedented for a hurricane to be headed right towards New York City. And then at 8 o'clock that morning, this thing makes a 110-degree turn and heads out of town. And there was lightning and thunder reported at numerous airports around New York City, which is indicative of field effects that they can be created from these hurricanes.
Well, I'll say again, there are all sorts of things that may be related here, but they're not things I deal with. I keep focusing on the official story about 9/11 and why it's false. So, you know, there may be something to that, but I'm not the one to talk to about it.
Now, let me
respond to the previous question about the dollar and, you know, what these guys were thinking. It's a good question. Do Bush and Cheney and Wolfowitz and Pearl, when they look at what has happened in Iraq and Afghanistan, do they say, oh, boy, we really screwed up? Or do they say, ha, we pulled off. We did, you know, people are ridiculing us, but we did what we were supposed to do. I don't know, but I wouldn't be surprised with either answer.
You know, you brought up a good point, and I know that you cannot really determine what the motives were of the power elite or whomever it is, but the majority of people now believe that it was an inside job. If you were to just speculate, would you not think that 9/11 was to certainly confiscate many of our rights, our freedoms, to go to war with Iraq for oil, to put their money into our Federal Reserve, it's owned by private people. Could it be all those reasons, and it had absolutely nothing to do with terrorists supposedly bombing our buildings?
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, I mentioned earlier as motivations the desire, the preset desires to go to war in Iraq and Afghanistan, and then the desire to pass the Patriot Act, which eliminated a lot of our rights. With the Fed, I don't know. That's quite likely. But yeah, it had nothing to do with Muslim terrorists. I just published an article that's on that one can Google. Was America attacked by Muslims on 9/11? Because that's finally the bottom line about what 9/11 is all about. And the assumption that it was, you know, if you assume that we were, then you may say, well, okay, the war in Iraq is not justified because Iraq had nothing to do with it. But the war in Afghanistan is, because it was Osama bin Laden and these Muslim terrorists. But if you come to the realization, as I would call it, that there were no Muslim terrorists, then the war in Afghanistan is just as illegitimate as the war in Iraq. And in that article, I summarize the evidence that I've given in the book, or you could say the article is a way of summarizing the book from the point of view of that particular question. And I show that all the evidence that there were Muslim hijackers, you know, the so-called the passports that were allegedly found at the sites, the Muhammad Atta's luggage that had this incriminating information, and then most famously the phone calls from the planes, that all of these were fabricated. And once you see that, then you realize, oh, well, the whole thing is a hoax.
What is
called, of course, a false flag operation, which is when, it's the time-worn tradition of imperialist powers, when there's a country or a group that you want to attack, you attack yourself and then plant evidence to make it look like that group attacked you. That's what Japan did when it was ready to attack China to take over Manchuria, which started the Asian part of World War II. That's what the Germans did, the Nazis did, when they were ready to attack Poland, beginning the European part of World War II. And it's what the United States has done several times in the past, told a lie in order to attack somebody. So this is 9/11 can be regarded as simply the most audacious, largest false flag attack of all time.
Mm-hmm. That presents a question I want to ask you, and that is, many of us know that Bush signed an EO that would give him essentially dictatorial powers. I believe he did it this past July.
Yeah, Presidential Directive 51.
Thank you. Is it likely that he's going to say, well, we are in such bad shape here, economically, yada, 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 that we're not going to have elections until next year and then stay in as essentially the dictator?
Well, yes, and many of us in the movement have been very worried about that, that there would be some sort of staged event. We had thought in terms of, maybe a suitcase nuclear attack or something that would be blamed on Iran. But it could well be that the financial crisis would be taken as a sufficient crisis to declare martial law. And then we've seen this report the last few days of troops coming back to the United States to be used for policing our own citizens,
mm-hmm.
which is a violation, of course, posse comitatus.
Yeah.
But the precedent here was Katrina, and I've always been suspicious that one of the purposes behind Katrina, the non-response to it, was to set a precedent for having our military involved in policing within our own country. So, yes, and one reason many of us have spent so much time trying to educate the public about 9/11, that it was a false flag attack, is that the more people who know, and insofar as the government knows, a good percentage, 40-50% or more of the people know that 9/11 was a false flag attack, they might be less inclined to try it again.
Well, if that were the case, do you believe that we will go into martial law here soon and that they'll actually arrest Americans and put them into what people say exist are concentration camps?
Well, I'm not saying that I believe that is what will happen, but I do fear that it might happen, and I wouldn't be completely surprised if it did.
So you do think they do have a concentration camp for us here?
I've heard that. I've not seen direct evidence of it myself, but the reports that I saw seemed plausible.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, Gianni, we have a caller. Sheldon's on the line.
Okay.
Sheldon, are you with us?
Yes. Hi, Dr. Griffin. I came across yesterday an article in Foreign Affairs from 1998 that was written by Zelikow and Ashton Carter and John Deutsch, imagining the transformative event. Have you read that?
Well, yes. I discuss it in some of my books, including the latest one, The New Pearl Harbor Revisited. But go ahead.
Another example, everybody who's followed this is familiar with the PNAC wish list of events that would enable them to go off and do what they were aspiring to, and this is another example of that in my mind. Not only that, but Zelikow had was very active in creating the myth around 9/11 of the 19 hijackers and the entire narrative that that they used to sell this within the next few hours after 9/11 happened. I just wanted to get your comment on that.
Well, that's right, and the whole last chapter of the new Pearl Harbor Revisited is devoted to Zelikow and the 9/11 Commission report, and showing why, if they had really wanted an independent commission, a commission that was independent of the White House, Zelikow was the worst possible choice to be the executive director. Now, a lot of people are still under the illusion that the 9/11 Commission was run by Thomas Kane and Lee Hamilton, the chair and the co-chair, but they were largely figureheads who showed up for TV. And as Philip Sheehan, the New York Times reporter, tells us in his book, The Commission, they didn't even have offices there where all the work was done for the 9/11 Commission report. So they very seldom came by, and everything was run by Zelikow. So this should really be called the Zelikow Report. And, of course, he was essentially a member of the Bush-Cheney administration. And as Sheehan reports, he did not break his contacts with the White House while he was directing the commission. He stayed in touch with his old friend Condoleezza Rice, and he stayed in touch with Karl Rove, who was reportedly the guy in the White House who was most worried that the 9/11 Commission might say something that would hurt Bush's reelection chances. And so for many, many reasons, I've just got a new article I'm about to publish on this that will summarize what I've put in the book. Zelikow should not have been, and the point that you make is that that article showed that 3 years prior to 9/11, Zelikow was thinking about a catastrophic event involving the World Trade Center that would divide the American history into before and after, and even said that civil rights would be constrained and all sorts of things that proved to be true. So it was as if 3 years in advance he had an idea of what was going to happen.
He's a prognosticator, or he's a insider that made it happen.
Yeah, or maybe just, you know, was very clairvoyant.
Hmm. Okay, Shelton, anything else?
No, Johnny, it's a very good show. I'm enjoying this very much.
Well, thank you. Brian, I know you have something there.
I was just, this kind of harks back to the last question a little bit, but let me just run a scenario by you. You know, we have a 9/11 event. Then we implement the Patriot Act and Patriot Act 2. We start running up the deficit with a war on two fronts. We have Katrina, which suspends Posse Comitatus, and eventually the economy crashes, and we're looking at martial law in the NAU. I mean, this is all in one presidential, one president's series of terms. I mean, that almost sounds too unreal to believe, like out of a bad fiction book.
if a screenwriter had turned in a script that would tell the official story of 9/11 and then its aftermath, it would have been thrown in the trash can. The guy would have been laughed out of the office. The producer would have said, that is too ridiculous. That sort of thing could never happen. Just go through the whole story that amateur hijackers could fly planes through these amazing trajectories, particularly the one that hit the Pentagon. They could outsmart the most sophisticated, expensive air defense system in history. They could bring down three buildings at free fall speed by crashing planes into two of them, and on and on and on. And then all these follow-up scenarios that you've summarized. It is worse than Pulp Fiction, and yet that most people still say, well, yeah, it's a dangerous world.
Okay, I believe I'm getting a memo over here. Do we have another caller on the line?
I don't think so, Brian.
Okay, I got it.
Well, no, I don't think we do.
I thought I heard someone. Caller, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, we have 2 minutes, so we'll need to go real fast.
Okay, Dr. Griffin, is it your position that there was a pile on 9/11 at the World Trade Center? Is it your position that there was a lot of a big pile with 18 stories or so there that we could see and get pictures of?
Well, no. As I said earlier, each tower collapsed into a pile no more than 4, 5, or 6 stories high. And so almost all the concrete and all the materials in the buildings, all the desks and tables and computers and so on, were pulverized into this dust that came out, so that all that was left for the most part was the steel. And the steel was all conveniently sliced into pieces, most of it, and pieces about the right size to be put on trucks to be hauled away. So, no, there was no 18-story pile left.
Okay. Now, what do you think is going to be next that's going to happen? I mean, do you think they're going to try another some kind of disaster, or do you think that the economy is totally going to collapse? Just based on your reading and research, Dave, what do you think?
Well, here I'm with Yogi Berra, and I don't make predictions particularly about the future. So, you know, I just have no idea what is going to happen next. I certainly do fear the worst.
Well, I think that's what everybody... But you've been a wonderful guest, Dr. Griffin, and Brian and I are both very grateful. We thank you for coming on, and listeners, next week is Fred Coulter and Tex Mars. Thank you very much, Dr. Griffin. Good night, everybody. God bless.
Okay,
Brian.
Thank you, Gianni.
Well, thank you. Say good night, Brian.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. We'll see you next week.